And Scotty is very, very meticulous.
Never seen anybody like him in my whole career. I've never seen anybody. He is so conscious of when he puts it, and he stands there and looks at it.
And he's looking at this, but all that is a transference of the feel of what's up here.
Right.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Mm-hmm. All right, yeah, okay. I got this in here. Boom, and here we go.
Hi, this is Tony Ruggiero of the Tour Coach Podcast. Recently, I was invited once again up to the Gurus of Golf, which is an unbelievable experience and an unbelievable event hosted by Rob Aikens, one of the great teachers in the game. And all of that is done to raise money for Le Bonheur Children's Hospital up in Memphis. It's an amazing day and an amazing event. This year, Rob wanted to do something a little different, and on the evening before, have some of the great names in teaching and coaching that are part of this. The Randy Smiths, the Chuck Cooks, could go on and on. Tom Ness, who recently left us, used to come to this event. But Rob, realizing that as we all get older, there's this great generation of teachers that we should take advantage of and share some of their insights and their stories. And Rob did just that. And we're going to share them with you also. So sit back, relax. And if you love golf instruction and you want to learn, you're going to love these collections of interviews and stories with Rob Aikens from the Gurus of Golf in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, hey. So with me are two dear friends of mine. I've known them both for probably almost 40 years. And so it's Kip Earball and Randy Smith. And so I'll start with you, Kip. We met at the Masters in 1998. You know, at the time, Scott Simpson and Larry Mize, you were very involved, and Larry obviously won the Masters, and Scott won the U.S. Open. So two great players, and you've been in California, so it was like I grew up in Louisiana, you were in California, we were two different. You're on the moon compared to where I am, right? But we ended up meeting at Augusta and became dear friends right off the bat, and we've been friends ever since. And thank you for supporting our stuff here in Memphis. You come every year, and I just greatly appreciate it. You doing that, but it's been an honor to be a friend of yours and learn from you. So, you know, I'm going to tell you, this is a weird question, but what do you think the difference is between the game of golf on the West Coast and the game of golf in the South?
I've never been a question I've encountered before. I would say the West Coast, they probably not going to be as proficient as playing the wind and bad conditions because they get so much good weather out there.
Right. They're kind of soft.
That might be a good
one. I'm just kidding.
But, you know, so they probably don't have the same ability to play in the heavier wind and harsh conditions, I would say.
Right.
It's a little tougher. Your grass is generally softer, I would guess.
A little spongier, and the greens are different. I mean,
and then you got the bent greens everywhere where you can't do it. The bent greens are the devil in themselves. But you have to learn to put them. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting how some people can really play the West Coast. I mean, that's just somehow their eye, their game fits that, and then they struggle, you know, in the South. And there's some people that, like David Thomas, who was with me, he was not a very good guy on the West Coast for the most part. I mean, he had a few good runs when he was at his heyday, but, you know, Bermuda grass, the South where he grew up, you know, it's funny how you grow up in a certain environment and you seem to be able to, this innate, I don't know, sixth sense or whatever, you can kind of deal with the weather or the grass or whatever. It's just you're comfortable with it.
Right. Yeah. I remember I went to tour school in Florida, and I hadn't putted that dense of Bermuda before. That was a total shock.
Yeah.
I mean, hitting pitches into it, I was like, what am I doing down here? I'm trying to learn quick. It's a total different environment. If you go from San Diego to, let's say, anywhere in Florida.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I love grain. The grain was like a little bit of wind. The grainier it was, the better it was. I grew up with that. So, and it's like I could use that big grass. There wasn't enough grain. It's like, I can't read this stuff. I don't know what it's going to do, but that grain always would let me kind of see. So it's funny how what you grow up with, that's how you do. So, I mean, you've been around the game. You had two boys helped you with some of them. They're both really good players and becoming great teachers themselves in their own right. And you've been out there in California. So where do you think golf instruction is going? And where they're going, their game, 10, 15, 20 years from now?
Where are we going? Well, it seems like sometimes I think the more complicated I get, the more simple I try to simplify things. there's a lot of equipment out there that you can use that is very helpful in describing what the person's problem is. The challenge to me is always, what are you going to tell the person to do? Make them do what you want them to do. I mean, communication becomes the critical part of the instruction to me, is how do you communicate to that person an image or whatever you want, and it works. And then you try to have someone have the same exact problem, and you tell them the same thing, and nothing happens. And so it becomes a constant goal of mine is to try to figure out as many ways to tell people the same thing. It's kind of
I think it's a sale issue. I think certain people are gullible, and it doesn't hurt very much to sell them into doing it. And there's other people that you got to be really good at selling it to, even though it's the same information. So I find that if I can sell it good enough, then maybe they'll try. But I think that's something I fight all the time, too. I think as a teacher, we're all struggling with that same thing.
Yeah. I think sometimes the machinery is putting too much emphasis on some of your body motions. I feel like the best players have always swung the club, and that's a word I like to use constantly. What is the swing? Something moving in a free and unrestricted arc around the center of motion. And that's what the golf swing is supposed to be doing. It's moving free and unrestricted, and the majority of people you deal with have a hard time buying into it because they feel like they're losing control of the club.
Right.
And then they won't want to do it. And so our goal is to get people to learn, I hate to use the word, learn to swing the club. And then there's different things you're going to do once you can swing it that can accelerate it. But the club, first of all, to me, it's got to be, they got to understand freedom of motion.
Yeah, that was George Knutson's whole book was about that whole thing.
Yeah.
So he was a great player and wrote an incredibly good book. So I think you're right. I think it's gotten too complicated. There's too much information. I've done my best work with some of the students that I let them see the video at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
And they trusted my eye, and so they didn't get caught up in looking at the video and thinking so much. So I think that's the challenge as we get more and more data and more stuff. It becomes almost too much for the player to try to decipher, you know what I'm saying? Or to actually swing thinking about all that stuff.
Right.
You know? As a teacher, it helps us, but I don't know that it always helps the player. You know?
I know what I like to see in a golf swing, and my goal is to get them there. And that's how do you get to deliver a point that's going to make the club functional for them.
Right.
The minimum amount of flipping and most amount of speed. I was very fortunate. I grew up with Paul Runyon as my teacher when I was a young man. And he was very much into swinging the golf club. You know, he said, you got to swing it on a circle, and you got to get the club to go around, and you got to get the club to go as fast as you can past the ball. And that's pretty much where we stayed, besides being a stickler on the grip. I mean, I could be three stalls down hitting balls, and Runyon would watch my grip and say, keep your right hand strong again. I go, thanks for trying to fix it.
Sure.
He stuck on the grip and be like, stink on a pig. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I just learned I had to put my hands on.
Perfect. Every time.
Because Runyon didn't catch me. And then I heard the story what he had with Gene Littler. That's one fun story. But Littler won the San Diego Open as an amateur, won six tournaments a year in 56, 57, started struggling in 58. Couldn't play as well. Finally comes to Runyon and says, Paul, have you seen anything funny in my swing? I can't seem to figure out what's going on. I said, yeah, Gene, your right hand grip's got a little strong. So when you make a good swing, you hook it. And if you hook a couple, then you block it. So you put your right hand back up and grip it, and you'll win shortly. 3 weeks later, he won. And he comes back to Runyon and he says, why didn't you tell me that? He says, because you never asked. And that was Runyon.
Yeah.
Well, it's you never ask me, I'm not telling you.
Obviously, the grip is something that comes up just all the time. It's in everybody. It's number one fundamental, right? And it's funny, the guy sitting beside me has his student is the most obsessed about the grip of anybody I've ever watched. So I've been fortunate enough the last 4 years to be out in California, and Scotty Scheffler has come out there and practiced for a week or two, sometimes 3 weeks. And I've watched him a lot. I've never seen anybody that's so meticulous about putting his hands on the club, sometimes over and over and over. And so that's the first question I'm going to ask you.
Are you finished with Kip?
Well, we're going to go back to Kip.
I'm kind of enjoying Kip's stuff.
I understand. So we're talking about grip, though. So would you say of all the people you've ever taught that Scotty Scheffler's the most consistent, more obsessive about Griffin than Fleming, anybody else? That's my observation. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know anybody really in the same ballpark.
Right.
Of being, it's not so much obsession. It's a matter of him understanding the importance, how important his hands are on the club. You know, and everybody says, how can a turf player's grips never going to change? It's never, what the hell it doesn't? That's the number one spot. Well, but you can see issues then.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Well, they're a little puffy that day. They drank a bunch of red wine, whatever, their hands, whatever. If their grips are changing, the swings are changing.
Yeah.
And Scotty is very, very meticulous.
I've never seen anybody like him in my whole career. I've never seen anybody. He just so conscious of when he puts it, and he stands there and looks at it, you know, when he's practicing, and it's like, man, I've never seen anybody really take that much time trying to make sure they're close.
Well, if you notice while he's doing this, that shaft is, there's a movement in the shaft.
Well, sure.
Yeah. And he's looking at this, but all that is a transference of the feel of what's up here.
Right.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, okay. I got this. Yeah. Boom. And here we go. And then, you know, if you'll notice how he presents the club to the ball.
Absolutely.
He's here, and he may go down here for a second or two, but it's always back up in front to where he's looking at the grip here.
Yeah.
And if you do this, and you look down at this elbow and that elbow, guess what? They're both bent.
Right.
They're both relaxed. They're both comfortable. And then from that position, he presents the club with the ball. It doesn't go down here, arrange here on the ground, creating the tension that goes right straight to the non-field of the club head.
So the question that I wanted to ask you before you even actually came to Memphis this time, because I knew I was going to do this, was we've talked a bunch together. And in Memphis, we in Nashville, we used to do these week-long camps, and you would come. That was years and years ago. And we'd spend the week teaching 15 hours a day together. And I'll never forget the first time you told me, he said, I got this little boy I'm teaching. His name's Scotty Scheffler. And I don't know how old Scotty was then. It's 10 or 12. You didn't show me any video that first time, but you mentioned him to me. Of course, we were doing a junior golf school, right? We had 20 kids or whatever. And then the next year, you mentioned him again. And gradually, as he got a little older, I started keeping up with his career. And he was, you know, having a great career as a junior. But I sense, like, really early on that you had, which I think is key to an instructor, you got to believe in your student. You got to really believe. But you had a belief about Scotty pretty early on. And so what made you see that?
Let's put it this way. If you've got a kid 6.5 years old and he's coming out to the club with his parents, they have moved to town.
Right.
And I'm up there doing my thing. I'm working and teaching as well as head golf professional. And I get this call and said, yeah, we've got a couple that's coming out and they've got a young son with them. And, you know, could you spend a little time to go over and shake hands with, you know, just check them out.
Right, you know,
might sell a membership, you know, you never can tell. Oh, shit. Okay, what time are they coming out? Well, at the time he was coming out, I just finished with just one over there at the ball, whatever.
Right.
And they came out, and I see here comes this little kid, literally about this tall. Okay. He's got a bag, it's a little bit bunch of clubs, they're dragging the ground. He comes up there and stands at the tee, and they told him to go ahead and warm up, hit balls. And, you know, if I get a chance, you know, I'm down there. Mom and Dad back there and everything, I'll finish up. Like, let's go do this deal. Well, it's next coming of Tiger Woods. Here we go. I'm going to give him a speech. And how great little whoever he is. God, next coming of Tiger Woods. Walk down there and walk up, introduce myself. Nice people. How are you doing? Good to see you. What's your name? Scotty. Oh, good. You hit the ball, son. And I kind of looked at him. And as I was looking at him, it looked a little different. He's got a pair of khaki pants. It's probably more of a floor. A little white shirt. All the stuff, right? Little black belt, little bitty golf shoes, and pants. Even I was in shorts. And he said, balls there, and I got to watch him. I just kept watching. It wasn't how much the swing was working.
Sure.
And, you know, 6.5 years old, he's doing his thing. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing him stopping after 3 iron shots at one target. He changes this tarp. He changed to another tarp. He went back and got another club. I haven't said anything to him. Just sitting there watching. Well, it's been 10 minutes. I'm out of there, right? 30 minutes later, I'm still there. And I haven't said anything yet. Except, can you hit it up? You see him go up. You hit it down? It's a down. This way. This way. He's not hitting very far. All that's kind of cool. But the coolest thing about it was, and when I knew at that moment, and I mean, every shot he hit was tied to a specific target. Was not upset. He'd get upset if it wasn't on the target. You know, he might not hit it that well, but if the ball's on the target, that's okay. So everything revolved around the target. At that point, I thought that was odd. Because 6.5-year-old kids, it's prayer back and hit it, right? One hit this stuff. Ooh, what's this? Oh, didn't matter if it's set mark. His little forearm he had, little sawhorse, little thing. Forearm. Everything went to the target. And from that point, I looked at it, I looked over at him, and I said, do you think he could have a home here? Y'all need to get this taken care of tomorrow.
Well,
no doubt about it. Because that was the difference between all the other kids I've been looking at. Pardon. After all, it's kind of important.
I've prided myself on really trying to develop golfers in my whole life and kids, and taking kids from junior golf to college golf and everything. But when I think about your career, and I don't even know them all, but Justin Leonard, you know, and then Harrison, and Ryan Palmer, and Cody Gribble, Charlie, is it Holloman?
No, I didn't have Charlie.
You didn't have Charlie?
He's a friend. Nobody ever had Charlie.
Anyway, I don't know how many players you've had that went on to play at Texas, but it's just an enormous, you know, quality of work that you had. I know you're blessed that you had some good people, but I mean, you've had a lot of people swing a lot of different ways, and they've all been very successful, and I've always admired that about you.
Well, I really appreciate that, but, you know, sometimes you got to be able to ride at the right bus stop, and that bus comes along. And I was very fortunate to have this kid come up, but the biggest thing was, I feel like, you know, I can kind of go to some of the stuff I learned from Chuck for a long time when I was a little kid growing up, and watching Chuck go, think about this. You see something that could be special, and they have an excitement about learning and getting better and progressing, and you kind of get involved with them. The biggest thing you can do is not screw up where they're going. If you can direct them without re-erecting them, you're going to get ahead a lot quicker and a lot faster.
I think that's great. Well, I can't say thanks enough for both of your support. Y'all been with me through the whole thing here at Lovato, and I've been dear friends of mine. I've learned so much from both of you, and I'm honored to have you both here.
You bet. Long story.